Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, y'all, welcome back to part two here on the Friday, May 27th, 2022 edition of the Chase Thomas podcast. Getting this part two up a little late in the day, but really busy day on just the podcast writing and everything else front. Just been a busy Friday here in Knoxville, Tennessee. But Chandler Rome of the Houston Chronicle is on this edition of the podcast. So hope you guys enjoyed our conversation on all things Houston Astros. A little bit of college baseball talk to start things out. He's an LSU guy, me being a Tennessee guy. We talked about college baseball and Jay Johnson at LSU. And, you know, we didn't know at the time when we recorded this, but LSU and Tennessee face off tonight on the SEC tournament front. So very excited for that, to see how that unfolds. Tennessee, LSU, and the SEC tournament down there in Hoover, Alabama. Don't forget, folks, you can watch this program and keep up with all our videos and clips and all that good stuff on YouTube.com, type in the Chase Thomas podcast, like, subscribe, do all the good stuff. You can follow me on Twitter at @Chase_Thomas, like the Facebook page at Facebook.com/ChaseThomasWriter, email the program at ChaseThomasPodcast@gmail.com. Go check out the homepage, ChaseThomasPodcast.com. Subscribe to my writing. Wrote about Tennessee's victory over Vanderbilt yesterday and what happened there in Tennessee's 10-1 victory over the Commodores. You can read that at SportsRenaissanceMan.substack.com. Type in your email. Never miss any of my written content. Become a subscriber today. And yeah, all right, time for part two here on the Friday edition of the Chase Thomas Podcast. Uncle Darren, let's go.
Chase Thomas podcast. The Chase Thomas podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, we're back here on the Chase Thomas podcast, where I am now joined by Chandler Rome, who covers the first place Houston Astros out there in the AL West. Chandler, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Not too bad. Not too bad. Are you? I know you got your start with the collegiate beat, and you had the LSU baseball coverage. Got my Tennessee stuff on. It, ostensibly, Tennessee will be playing Vanderbilt at some point this week. Who's to say the SEC tournament might last for 3.5 weeks? We'll see. But if rain does not cooperate anytime soon. But do you miss the collegiate beat? Do you still watch a lot of college baseball or no?
I do, actually. I've got a good bit of connections in the college baseball world. You know, Nolan Kane, who's Texas A&M's recruiting coordinator, was an assistant at LSU, one of my favorite people. Mm. Paul Maneri coached at LSU my entire tenure covering them. He's a great man. I covered Brad Bohannon's first year at Alabama for a newspaper over there. And, you know, just by virtue of just who the Astros have drafted in recent years, you know, I've had great conversations with Tony Vitello before. He's amongst one of my favorite people to interview, and I've only interviewed him 2 or 3 times, but he's so candid, and I know that's sometimes to his detriment, but for a reporter, it's awesome. you know, I do miss kind of some parts of college baseball, but I think once you get to professional ball, once you get to watch, you know, MLB on a daily basis, you kind of realize that they're kind of playing two different games, just given the level.
What do you mean?
Just given like the level. I mean, obviously the wood bats and the metal bats are two different, or aluminum bats are two different things, but just the way the games are managed and just the skill level, to be honest with you. I mean, like I've watched a few LSU games this year just because that's where I went to school. I went to LSU. I'm from Baton Rouge. And I keep up with them, and, you know, they've got two legitimate candidates to go 1-1. In the next two drafts, and Jacob Berry and Dylan Cruz, and like watching those two guys play and then watching like the rest of that team play, it's just like you can just tell that they're on two different stratospheres. Now, when you put Jacob Berry and Dylan Cruz in like double A or triple A, they're going to be kind of on a level playing field, and that's kind of what I'm getting at. You know, some teams have, like Tennessee's got a good club, but you know, of that club, how many of those guys are going to be everyday big leaguers? Like, one, maybe one or two?
Well, I mean, pitchers is different, but I mean, I think if you throw Joyce, will be somewhere. They'll figure it out. Joyce in the flamethrower. He's going to be it. Jordan Beck will probably be an everyday. Gilbert, I don't know. Lipscomb, I think, has everyday potential. I guess we'll see with Blade if he's an everyday star. I don't know. I think there's a handful.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm getting at is like the depth.
Wait, hold on. Are we sure this year's Tennessee baseball team cannot beat the Cincinnati Reds in a 3-game series? Are we sure?
I don't know, man. But I mean, but look, like that this Tennessee team, right? We're talking about them as like maybe one of the best college baseball teams ever. Like, like regardless of what happens in the next 3 weeks, like just what they did in the SEC and everything, and still we're only talking about like a handful of big league guys. And you know, it's just a depth thing, and it's just the way the games are managed. Like, I mean, I saw Jay Johnson the other day. You know, the Rays would do this, but like I saw Jay Johnson the other day, LSU's coach. He pulled his starting pitcher after one pitch. He put him in. He was going to do a lefty righty sort of matchup thing. Wanted to throw Ole Miss off. Kid threw one pitch, gave up a double, and pulled him and went with the lefty to face the next three lefties. Like that. Like obviously with the three batter rule, you can't do that in big league ball. But like, yeah. I mean, that's just different. And like the way that you have to manage, and just like the scholarship limits and the
the lack of
full time coaches. I mean, it's kind of a travesty what college baseball coaches have to go through. You know, it's kind of weird. You know, here in Houston, you know, Lance Berkman and Jose Cruz Jr. both recently got college baseball jobs. One, Jose Cruz is at Rice, and Lance Berkman's at HBU. And neither of those teams were any good this year. Now, granted, neither of those situations were great that they inherited. But the thought going through my head the whole time has been like, why would these guys want to coach college baseball? It is an unforgiving grind. Like, you have two paid assistants. You have 11.7 scholarships. You've got to recruit these kids starting at 12 years old with no money to give them. You've got to go up against the big league draft. For these two guys, you've got to go up against Power 5 schools. It's like, I have all the respect in the world for college baseball coaches, because it is such an unforgiving – it's an unforgiving occupation. And, you know, only a few – even those at the elite level, like Chris Lemonis at Mississippi State, who's getting, you know, whatever resources he wants, you know, Tony Vitello, you know, guys that are getting a ton of resources, you know, it's still hard on them because they're not getting any more scholarship money. You know, Tim Corbin can work around and get a little more money here and there and guys like that. But, like, it's a grind for everyone. And even when you make it to the top, you can't stop working. So, I guess long rambling story short, you know, I do miss kind of the intricacies of college baseball, but it's a much cleaner product to watch at the big league level.
It seems like the games move smoother. I think, I wonder if there's like a, if we could find somebody at Fangraphs. Shout out Fangraphs. I need you to do like a full on study as the average length of a college baseball game versus Major League Baseball game, because I feel like it's an hour difference most of the time.
Well, this Jay Johnson era at LSU, he's like, I haven't watched a ton of their games, just reading, like,
yeah,
he's making mound visits every, like, there's no mound visit limit in there. He's making mound visits like every other pitch. Like, he's using 8 and 9 pitchers, and part of that's just by necessity because they don't have a Nola or a Gausman or a Boucher or any of those sort of ace frontline guys. So he's having to mix it up, and it's kind of slowed the game down to a trickle. And I know that's LSU fans love when they win and they're winning and they're a top four seed and they're probably going to host a regional. But like, when you don't win and you play an unappealing brand, it could go pretty poorly.
Yeah, and those Tuesday games are just a slog, man. Tennessee, just like, Belmont's a good team, and they came in just 18-0, just obliterated them. And those Tuesday ones, they go for a while, and it's just like, what a waste of time.
I don't miss midweek games.
Yeah, they're the worst.
I don't miss – can I curse on this?
Yeah.
I don't miss fans bitching that they lose midweek games when they're throwing the 27 – when they're throwing like the 35th guy on the 35-man scholarship roster in the eighth inning, and – he gives up the lead to a team like a middle of the road, like in-state team that's playing this game as if it's game 7 of the World Series. Like, in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter, but fans get so lit up. So I do not miss covering midweek games.
Yeah. What did LSU fans, how did they feel about Tennessee fans? Because it feels like people are really just, this Tennessee team has ticked off so many people, and everyone's just waiting for us to go down in flames in Omaha or the regionals.
I mean, I'm pretty disconnected from
LSU. Well, I'm saying back in your day.
I mean, they were, I mean, no offense, Tennessee was irrelevant. when I was there. I mean, and a lot of, you know, I believe that was the end of the Todd Raley era into the Dave Serrano experiment.
Yeah.
I think that was when I was there.
Okay.
I mean, they were kind of a real, I remember Lou Kochaver for a hot minute, but other than that, like baseball wise, Tennessee was kind of irrelevant. So I don't know, but I was kind of quietly hoping that they would hire that LSU would hire Tony Vitello, just because
I was nervous about it.
Just because, you know, I think the one thing about LSU baseball fans, I compare it a lot. I compare the program and I compare the following a lot to Kentucky basketball. It's like they've been good forever, and a lot of their fans live in the past. Like they think that Skip Bertman did no wrong, and Skip Bertman was operating under the same restraints that everyone has now, which is just not true. And the fan base, to a large extent, is a lot of older people. It's a lot of older people that sit on their hands and that wail and gnash teeth when, you know, they lose a midweek game or they lose a series, and they lose sight of the broader perspective. And, you know, I've never been to Rupp Arena, but I've kind of heard that that's the same way there. It's not a particularly intimidating environment. It's just a lot of old people that have had season tickets for 40 years, just kind of sitting there watching what's going on. And it's a lot of it with LSU baseball. And I kind of thought that LSU baseball needed they were stale. They kind of need an asshole. Like they kind of needed that Tony Vitello like person to come in and kind of shake some people up and, you know, get the students out again. I mean, the student section at LSU baseball is just non-existent. Like they don't get a younger, like rowdy crowd there. It's a lot of fuddy-duddy old people that, you know, that say, you know, they're fire the hitting coach when they don't get six hits in an inning, or, you know, it's a bunch of like 50-year-olds that coached their kids in travel ball 10 years ago and think they know what's going on. Like it's not a great, you know, scene, but I thought Tony Vitello could come in and kind of shake it up. But I like the Jay Johnson hire. I think he's done a pretty good job so far.
Do you see a lot of, when you're talking to guys and on the MLB level and the Astros and stuff, do they still like talk about college baseball and like look at it fondly?
Bregman does. I've covered Bregman since he was 18, a freshman at LSU, and he follows them pretty close, and he was informed, I'll put it to you that way, on the LSU coaching search.
Interesting.
I don't want to say he had like a big hand in it, but they turned to him for advice, and he openly says that they turned to him for some advice. And, you know, some guys in there, Ryan Stanek in the Astros clubhouse, he played at Arkansas. I've talked to him about Dave Van Horn a few times, just nothing like in depth or anything. But also these guys are so obsessed, they're so in the grind of the season that they can't really pay attention too much. Like Jason Castro and I were talking about Stanford a couple of days ago. It's like, I just every time I open Twitter, I follow them on Twitter and I see they win. Like I couldn't tell you who's on the team. I couldn't tell you if they have any draft prospects, but I know they've won a bunch. And he's a pretty, you know, ardent follower of Stanford. So I think, you know, these guys don't forget where they came from, but they've got, you know, kind of bigger fish to fry, I think, especially when they're in season.
Who do you enjoy talking to most on this current Astros team?
It depends on kind of what you're talking about. Like, I think Bregman probably explains hitting and explains kind of his mechanics better than just about anybody. You know, I think if I need a technical baseball question, like, hey, why is your launch angle this? Or like, why are you not, like, I go to Bregman for that because he can explain it. You know, I may not even understand it the way he explains it, but he can, like, you know, get down to a really micro level and really kind of tell you what's going on. I think Justin Verlander's really insightful, you know, on big picture topics, kind of, you know, he's a consummate pro, kind of you know, when the cameras turn on, he's really, really good. And he can be good off camera too. And, you know, when he wants to talk about something and when you show interest, you know, he's really good. But this is a decent clubhouse for insights. And, you know, it's always kind of the secret in baseball writing is like, always make friends with the catchers because they know what's going on. And, you know, Martin Maldonado and Jason Castro are two great guys. You know, Castro went to Stanford, very well-spoken, very cerebral. And then, you know, Maldonado's good because this Astros rotation has a lot of Latin players. I think 4/5 of their rotation is Latin American. And, you know, I think, I'm trying to think, two of them speak English, but with an interpreter. and the other two speak no English. So it can be a little bit difficult to, I mean, I can have, you know, through interpreter conversations, I can get kind of down to the bottom of what's going on with them, but I can go to Maldonado, who is bilingual and who can maybe explain it and distill it a little bit better than they could. So, and then, you know, obviously relievers are kind of they're the odd species of big league clubhouses. You know, they're great guys and they're great. Most of them are excellent guys, but you know, they're very superstitious, you know, they don't want to talk when things are going well. It's hard to talk to a reliever when he's pitching well, cause he doesn't want to disrupt his rhythm. But then on the other end, you know, when a reliever blows a game or blows a save, they get upset when we ask to speak with them. And it's like, well, you can't have it both ways. Like you've got, I want to talk to you when things are going well, and I'm going to have to talk to you when things are going bad. So we're going to just have to kind of find a happy medium. But I think the Astros just in general, the last 4 or 5 years have certainly developed a reputation just outside of Houston for kind of who they are and what they do. But I think inside it's a really good, you know, clubhouse for me, just as far as insights and people, you know, kind of explaining the game to someone who thinks he knows what's going on.
Who do you think is the most misunderstood Astro?
Probably Altuve. The one thing I always tell, you know, young writers or young reporters or media people is like, you never assume you know these people. Like, I mean, I've covered Alex Bregman for, most of his like affiliated baseball career, and I would never, and I know his family. I've texted with I have relationships with them. I would never claim to know him. I don't know what he does when he leaves the clubhouse. I don't know what he does at home. And I'm not trying to say he's doing anything bad. I'm not trying to say he's doing anything. We don't know these guys. We get a very limited portrait of these guys from the access that we get with them. So I want that to kind of be the overriding thing here. Like even when from what I'm about to say, you know, I don't know what Jose Altuve does when he goes home. I don't know. You know, everything I've heard and everything I've seen, he seems like a fantastic father. He seems like a good person. He seems like he cares for his family and cares for people. But, like, he's also manifested this, like, reputation as, like, this villain, as, like, the guy that's, like, just the heel and just this, you know, face of this sign-stealing scandal when, you know, anybody you talk to from that 2017 team, whether you believe them or not, they say that Altuve didn't use the scheme. That he became very vocal and yelled at when they did try to bang a trash can during his at bat. He came back one time and yelled at the people that did it and said, never do that again. Now that doesn't absolve him because he was a part of the team. He won the MVP that year.
Yeah.
We'll never know how much he benefited. I mean, he says he didn't do it, but we can never actually like crystallize like who benefited the most, who didn't benefit, things like that. So, but I do think Altuve just by virtue of his prominence and his face, you know, he has become like the face of this scandal. And I just don't think,
do you think he knows that?
Oh, I know he knows it. I know. And I just don't think that is, I don't think that's warranted. I think he certainly shares blame. Everyone that was on the team shares blame because they all could have done something to stop it. They all could have spoken up and they've lost the benefit of the doubt just going forward in their careers. And this is a stain that they're going to have to wear for however long they play baseball. But I think to pigeonhole Altuve as the guy that is like the big like ringleader, the guy, the face of this scandal, I think that's a little misunderstood because, you know, in all of my interactions with him and, you know, observing him for 5 years now and everything I've heard from people that know him, he is the opposite of like a dirty cheater. Like he's got two young girls at home. He's got a wife. He's got a family that he's very close to. He does a lot of charitable things outside of the public eye. He signs for fans very regularly. Like he's very judicious with his time, very generous. Again, this all with the caveat. I don't claim to know him. I don't claim to know these guys, but I think if there's one that's probably misunderstood, it's him.
What's the biggest difference between Click and Lundhau?
Well, Click has a little more human side to him. Jeff Luhnow, and this was outlined in Rob Manfred's investigation of the team that was released in January 2020. You know, that Jeff Luhnow cultivated an insular culture that didn't work well with people. And Jeff did not have, I don't think, the humanity that James Click has. Like, if you talk to James Click, like, it feels like you're having like a conversation with like another human being. It feels like he values like your feelings, and he values you more as more than just, in my case, a reporter, or as a player, and in their case, like more than a number on a spreadsheet, more than like a piece of this grand puzzle that he's putting together. And look, it worked for Jeff Luhnow. I mean, like, the reason, like, Jeff Luhnow deserves a huge amount of credit for where the Astros are right now as a franchise, stability and everything that they have, just the sustainability, and that their window's open. But, you know, the way he went about it certainly rubbed people the wrong way. He did not have a lot of friends in the game. There's a reason he's not back in baseball, and there's a reason that I don't think he'll ever be back in baseball. I don't think he wants to be back in baseball, but I think, you know, the minute he got suspended and fired, I think the industry-wide consensus was that you wouldn't see him back in baseball. And I think that's certainly going to be the case. And part of it is because, you know, he did alienate himself from a lot of people, from a lot of people in the game, from a lot of important people in the game. And then I think he kind of sealed his fate when he sued the Astros and claimed that Crane and Rob Manfred entered into a collusion to get him fired. I think that pretty much sealed his fate, that he'll probably never work in baseball again. But yeah, I just think James, certainly Click, they come from the same like analytical sort of background. Like, Click comes from the Tampa Bay Rays, who are the most analytical bunch in baseball. And, you know, I think they think a lot of the same way about baseball. You know, Click has added more scouts that Luhnow purged, and you know, he thinks that the human element's a little more important, that being at the ballpark, that these scouts seeing guys in person is a little more important than Jeff did. But I think in some ways they're pretty similar, but I think just personality and kind of the culture that they cultivate in the front office, and just things I hear from people that have worked for both men, they couldn't be much more different, just in the office and kind of the culture they've cultivated.
Was there ever a chance that Correa was going to sign a long-term deal with the Astros?
Not long term, not long term. They don't do that. They've never the longest free agent deal under in Jim Crane's ownership. The longest free agent deal they've ever given to a domestic free agent is 4 years and $52 million to Josh Reddick.
Why is that?
They were because they don't believe that. They have never believed in, under Crane, under Luhnow, and now, I mean, it's kind of bearing fruits under Click, that they've just never believed in the long term deal. They are now, where the conversation is interesting is like the deal that Correa ended up signing with the Twins is one that the Astros, that is like their calling card. Like, they gave Justin Verlander a 2-year, $66 million extension a couple of years ago with a $33 million AAV. Michael Brantley's on a 2-year, $32 million deal right now. Granted, those are like smaller, and I mean, but low, few years, big AAV. That is what the Astros do. Like, that is the, like, and that's what we, that's what I wrote, that's what everyone wrote, kind of all lockout and dragging in spring training, is if the Astros are going to get this done, it's going to have to be a short-term, big-money deal, because that's all they do. But it was well known that Correa wanted 10 years for $300 million, and he still wants that, and he's going to probably get it after he opts out this year with the Twins. But it does, you know, kind of raise the question, why couldn't the Astros do what the Twins did? And a lot of the talk has been about they didn't like the opt-outs in there, which I guess that's their prerogative. We're 2 months into it, so they can't claim any victories, but Jeremy Pena has been playing very well.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. They just know what they had in Pena.
Well, again, it's 2 months. Every fan that's saying the same thing, everybody that I was like, check with me in September, check with me in October. Let's look at these guys' wars in October. You know, everyone freaked out yesterday because Jeremy Pena got a day off, and they had to bring up that, you know, Jeremy Pena has never played more than 109 games in any professional season. That was in 2019. So he's barely, like, he had a wrist injury in last season that limited him to about 40 minor league games. Nobody played minor league baseball in 2020. He's like barely played baseball the last 2 years. And now they're going to throw him into a situation where they want him to play 145, 150 games plus the playoffs. Like, how's he going to hold up? Like, I think that's a big story in the second half. Cause, like, look, he has outperformed any expectations that people had for him. He is, he's playing really well. By war, he's their best player. He's made more contact than I thought he would make. The power I always knew was there, and then, you know, the defense, that was kind of his calling card. But I mean, is he going to be able to sustain this? Like, how is he going to be able to sustain this into September and October? I think it's a huge storyline in the second half. So right now it looks fine. You know, right now it's like, yeah, they knew what they had in Jeremy Pena, but I mean, I think you have to, it's way too early to jump to like, oh, that's why they didn't sign him, because they knew that this kid was the next coming. Well, we don't know that this kid's the next coming. Like, he's, it just so happens that he has started better than every other American League rookie, which is commendable, certainly. But I kind of want to pump the brakes, maybe wait until September or October. And look, if he keeps this going, then they do deserve a ton of credit for knowing what they had in him and not, you know, maybe getting Correa back.
Are they okay with the situation in center field?
I think if there is an avenue to improve the club at the deadline, I think outfield is certainly, I mean, it's the only place. They're first base, but they're not going to, I think Yuli Gurriel is kind of, no matter how poorly he hits, which his decline has been pretty precipitous, just as someone that won a batting title last year. I think Yuli Gurriel is kind of safe. I mean, you want a gold glove. His defense hasn't faltered. I think they're going to, but they do need another bat. I think they're a bat short, you know, especially like what we were just talking about with Pena. Like, what if he drops off in the second half? Then you've got for all intents and purposes, a 5-man lineup. Cause if Gurriel keeps this going, he's a below average hitter.
Yeah.
So, I mean, center field would be the area that they could stand to upgrade the most, but like, I don't know what center fielders are going to be available. The center field free agent market was not robust this offseason. They were in on Starling Marte, but
can I interest you in an Adam Duvall?
I mean, look, he haunted them in the World Series last year.
There you go.
As did every other trade acquisition the Braves made. But I think if there's an avenue that they're going to improve the club, it's got to be offense. And again, we're talking on May 26th. You know, they could, heaven forbid, injuries, but they could have two pitchers blow out and they could need a pitcher. Who knows? But we're talking on May 26th. The area to improve the club is probably they need a bat. And without knowing who's available, it's tough for me to say that they have to go center field. You know, they could go get a corner outfielder and move Kyle Tucker to center field. They could do that if there's a good corner bat available.
But, Byron Reynolds, I mean.
They don't have the farm system for that. They don't have the farm system to go get Brian Reynolds. You know, there's like this fantasy, if Juan Soto's available, like, it's just it's like they don't have the farm system for
that. Well, it's also he's going to – you talk about a deal, long-term deal. That man
– right, and they would never extend him. Mm-hmm. Like, but everyone remembers that they had an agreement in principle to acquire Bryce Harper in 2018. But that was – Harper was a year away from – like, that was a rental. Like, he was going to play 2 months and leave, and they weren't going to extend him. So that's not how this Soto thing would work, and they just don't have the prospect capital. I mean, they've got some prospects that are starting to crack the top 100, but not near enough. And then, you know, everyone throwing out, like, Chaz McCormick and Jose Siri is, like, trade. And it's like, yeah, they're fine players, but, like, that's not going to get you Juan Soto. Like, you can't trade, like, Chaz McCormick and a couple, like,
I don't think anything's going to anybody wants Soto. There's no deal that makes sense for both sides with that one, because what it would cost to get, like,
well, they'd have someone. I think someone would have to take on Corbin's contract, Corbin or Strasburg's contract too, as like a month.
Yeah, I mean, even if you do that, the amount of capital that you're giving up, it's like, how do you keep a contending window with Juan Soto when you gave up everything to get him? I don't know.
It'd have to be like the Dodgers.
The Dodgers. That's like it.
Steve
Mets, Cohen, I guess.
Steve Cohen's. Yeah. Steve Cohen. I would say the Mets would probably be in there too. But yeah, it makes sense for very few teams.
Yeah.
And the Astros, it does not make sense for at all.
Yeah. I think America is waiting on Juan Soto and Ronald Acuña in the outfield. Personally, I think that is something that America.
Well, look, the Braves were in on Correa.
Were they?
They were in on Correa. They were pretty in on it.
Why do you think it didn't pan out? I didn't hear this.
I don't know. I don't know what the offer was, but I know they were in on him at the very end.
Especially with that deal. Like, that's a very Braves light thing, a 1-year deal.
Right. And same thing I wondered with the Astros. Like, why didn't the Astros do this? What is Swanson's contract status? I don't remember.
That's what I'm wondering. And what if it's like a Swanson thing? But I mean, the Dansby Swanson experience. Nice guy, good defense, but it's just, he's not going to hit at this level. Like, it's just, it's not coming. The bat's not coming. He's just a fine
And I mean, I bet they were kind of, I bet they kind of would have done what the Twins did, which is
yeah.
I mean, they traded Kiner Falefa, and then, you know, 2 days later, hey, Correa's here.
True.
But yeah, the Braves were, I mean, and I don't know if that would have softened the blow of losing Freddie Freeman, but they were in on it. That would have been,
I don't know how Atlanta's response would have been to that, because, I mean, you just beat the Astros to win the World Series, and Correa is a kind of divisive figure. I don't know how that would have played out in the PR front, bringing in Correa, moving on from Freeman. But the Freeman thing is, a lot of folks, and that's kind of come out now, is like, he didn't want to be a Brave at the end of the day. Like, that was kind of that relationship was getting pretty bad. And you listen to Chipper Jones' interview about it, and I don't know. It seems like that was a bad situation over the course of like a year. It seemed like that was not gonna work long term, but it's tough. I don't know. He still got the ring. Still got the ring. That's all that matters, right?
Flags fly forever.
Flags fly forever. We'll end on this. So, weirdly enough, the Angels are right there, going back and forth with the Astros atop the AL West. The Mariners, a lot of folks thought, and then the Rangers, maybe if like everything went right, they just spent a lot, so people were like, oh, are they ready? It's like, well, they still don't have a lot of depth everywhere else. They just, that was like step one in the jumpstart this rebuild, was Semien and Seager, and Semien has been not good, to say the least, to this point in the season. But when you look at the Angels roster,
45 OPS plus.
Huh?
Like that is awful.
Oh yeah, no, it's bad.
I mean, bad. Yeah, it's. I mean, you know, the West. It's, is Taylor Ward going to keep being like the best player in baseball for like the next 4 months? I think that has a big factor in it. I mean, you know,
have they had a series with the Angels yet?
The Astros, yeah, they opened the season with four in Anaheim, and then they came here for three, and I think the Astros went 4-3 against them. They're either 4-3 or 5-2 against them. But Trout was like, still had a stomach bug for the season opening series, so he didn't play one game and like was pretty hampered in the other two. So like I don't think they saw him at full strength. And Taylor Ward again wasn't doing what he's doing now. I think if Ward keeps this up, you know, the Angels are owned by a guy that Artie Moreno, who, if they are in contention at the deadline, they will go all in. I think like they will be aggressive and go all in. They don't have the prospect capital to make it work. They could trade Joe Adele, because I think as long as Taylor Ward keeps playing like this, I don't know where he's going to see the field.
And he hasn't been good when he has.
Well, no, but he's tearing up AAA pitching, so he doesn't need to be in AAA. I think, you know, that's going to be the interesting thing. Like, if we get down to the deadline and it's still like the Angels are within two or three games of the division lead and like have a, like, and the wild card, like they're going to be aggressive. And if they add, like, I mean, I don't know if they would do an interdivision trade with, like, would they go get Luis Castillo? Would they go get Frankie Montas? Like, would they go get another starter to, like, cause I think their starters have held up relatively well. You know, Syndergaard's been good, but they're going to have to baby him with coming off Tommy John. Otani's been much better as a pitcher than a hitter, and his pitching's improved so much from last year. Lorenzen's been good. Detmers has struggled his last couple starts, and he threw a no-hitter like 2 weeks ago. I think if they can get another starter, you know, their bullpen is quietly one of the better bullpens in baseball. Like, Iglesias is a really good closer, and they've got Loop, Tapera, you know, Archie Bradley, guys that have gotten big outs, you know, in big situations. So, I mean, I think on paper they're built to, I wouldn't say challenge the Astros for the division, but like I think they're gonna hang around. Like, barring an injury to Trout, barring a Otani just completely cratering, you know, they're gonna hang around. So, I think it'll be interesting too, because like we finally get to see Mike Trout and Shohei Otani play like meaningful games, because I love watching them, but like there's a difference in watching them when the games mean nothing in August, as opposed to like with a division on the line, or like with a, you know, if they win this game, they go up a game in the division, or they fall two back. Like that would be great just to see these two guys, or three really, with, I mean, we've seen Rendon playing big games before, but Trout and Otani, to see them in like meaningful September baseball, I think it would be great for the sport. Selfishly, it would be great for me just to be able to watch it. But it'd be great for the sport. And something that the sport needs, to be honest with you, because, like, they did wonders last year with Otani, like, marketing him, like, making the All-Star game all about him. And that was awesome. But, like, when the two best players in the sport, when the two most, like, talented guys are never they play on the West Coast, so a bunch of the country can't watch them. Mm. And B, like, when they're never in big games, it's like it's tough to get traction. But I think getting these guys into September and keeping them in the division hunt, I think that would be really, really good for baseball.
We shall see. We shall see. Chandler, what can the good folks check out from you across the Houston Chronicle this week?
Yeah, I fly to Seattle later on today, and they're going to be another 9-game, 3-city road trip. It seems like the Astros have played a ton of those lately, but be there the whole time at Chandler_Rome on Twitter, and just follow the, some say the most hated team in baseball, definitely the most polarizing team in baseball. Certainly they're it's never boring. It's never boring covering them, and you can see the fruits of that labor on HoustonChronicle.com.
There you go. I'm right there with you with the Tennessee baseball team, so it's there's the connection. I know what it's like to cover the villains of a baseball industry. Chandler, thank you so much for making the time. I greatly appreciate it. We'll have to check back in again soon.
All right.
All right, that'll do it for part two here on the Friday, May 27th edition of the Chase Thomas Podcast. Hope you guys enjoyed. Chandler Rome of the Houston Chronicle coming on this edition of the podcast. So thank you again to Chandler for coming on to talk all things Astros and a little college baseball. Give him a follow on Twitter and keep up with all of his great work over at the Houston Chronicle today. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure you leave this show a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, if that is how you are listening to today's feed. Subscribe and like on our YouTube page, youtube.com, type in the Chase Thomas Podcast. You'll find us there. Subscribe to the Sports Renaissance Man. That's me, sportsrenaissanceman.substack.com. Tweet at me at @Chase_Thomas. Like the Facebook page at facebook.com/ChaseThomasWriter. And email the program at chasethomaspodcast@gmail.com. Jam-packed show coming to you guys tomorrow, so look out for 3 different parts to this podcast tomorrow, so check that out right here on the Chase Thomas Podcast here at the Blue Wire Pod Network. That is it for me. You guys have a great rest of your Friday evening, and I will talk to you all tomorrow. Uncle Derek, how'd I do?
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.